Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. I don't need to say much, probably taking the very warm welcome that we have just heard. But it is my duty as the chair of tonight's event to have the honor to introduce our main speaker for the evening. My name is Miria Georgiou. I'm the head of department in the Department of Media and Communications, and I am actually standing in for our dear colleague, Professor Bingqing Meng, who was supposed to be chairing this event, but she has been caught out in another continent because of her travel plans being delayed. Because she's not here, I'm standing here as a chair, but I want to share her own words, the words that she has warmly prepared to introduce Professor Banaji tonight. So I want to welcome those of you in the room. I want to welcome those of you online. A special shout out for the MCD community around the world that are joining us from different parts of the world. So these are the words that Professor Bingqing Meng prepared for tonight's event. It is my great honor and my personal joy to welcome you to this long overdue inaugural lecture by Professor Shakuntala Banaji. Let me begin, not with the usual curriculum vitae, but with something more important. Shaku is, first and foremost, a person who pays attention. Anyone who has sat in a seminar she has led or shared a corridor conversation with her will know what I mean. She listens with a kind of full-bodied and hard attention that has become almost revolutionary in the age of distraction. That kind of radical attentiveness is the hidden architecture beneath everything she has built as a scholar and as a human being. As a teacher, Shaku is quite simply transformative. Her students do not merely learn a discipline, they learn a way of being in the world. They learn to ask whose knowledge counts and whose is erased, to follow an argument wherever it leads, even when it is uncomfortable, and to bring both intellectual rigor and genuine compassion to the questions that matter the most. As a mentor, she gives time she doesn't have. She replies to the panicked email sent at midnight before the Viva. Not that I'm encouraging you to do that. She reads the draft that is not yet ready to be read. She sits with a student who lost a sense of direction, not to offer easy consolations, but to think alongside them until a way forward becomes visible again. In the neoliberal academy that is both fiercely competitive and hierarchical, Shaku has chosen again and again the ethic of accompaniment over the economy of prestige. As a researcher, her scholarship is breathtaking in its ambition and its precision. Her work on media, youth, politics, and ideology, spanning across South Asia, Europe, South America, and beyond, refuses the false comfort of simple narratives. She has mapped the ways in which young people navigate propaganda, desire, democracy, and disillusionment with an analytical eye that is matched only by her deep empathy for the people whose lives she studies. And that is going to be the focus of her talk today. Speaking still through the words of Bingqing Meng, as a friend and comrade, those of us lucky enough to occupy this category know something the footnotes do not capture. We know the generosity on her table. We know the fierceness of her loyalty and the warmth of her wit. We know that she shows up in the picket line, in the seminar room, and in the Solidarity March. Her commitment to social justice is not a rhetorical stance or a professional identity. It is the animating force of the life lived with extraordinary coherence between what she believes and what she acts. Shaku has always believed and taught those around her to believe that another world is not only necessary, but imaginable. That is the most difficult thing to sustain at the current historical conjuncture. Not just anger at what is wrong, but genuine, evidence-based, clear-eyed faith that things can be otherwise. And so it is entirely fitting that tonight's lecture is titled Infinite Justice, Political Cosmologies That Protect Our Future. I need now to share with you some housekeeping information, just to remind everyone to keep their phone on silent or switched off, to remind those of you at X that you can comment on tonight's event by using the hashtag LSEEvents. This event is being recorded and hopefully it will be made available as a podcast. After Professor Banaji's talk, we will have time for Q&A and we'll invite questions both from the room and from the online audience. And after the event, we invite you all to join the reception just at the atrium outside. With this, it is with great pleasure that on behalf of Professor Meng and on behalf of the Department of Media and Communications, I present to you Professor Shakuntala Banaji.
So much. I feel like I'm in the room with my family. I am actually in the room with my family, and I'm also in the room and online with dozens, if not hundreds, of people that I hold very, very dear and whom I know are working away, beavering away to bring hope in the various communities that they're in. I found today's task quite a difficult task. I woke up at 3 in the morning one day when Luam was asking me to come up with a title, and I came up with this title. And then I regretted it for weeks afterwards, because it's something I'm working on and thinking about, but as the weeks passed, the world started drifting into worse and worse territories. More and more people were dying, and I had to try to make sense of what I had cut out for you and for me to do today, to try to make sense of a way through this that would take us beyond despair, beyond a sense that we are just having to survive, but that we can actually do something to make things better. So partly in honor of my own deafness and that of my deaf friend who's in the room, I write everything out on the slides. So I'm already apologizing that they're very writing heavy. But I will read them too, and if you're online and I go too fast, indicate, and I will slow down. I wanted to define my terms to begin with. So let's start with cosmologies, and let's think about why I didn't choose philosophy or politics as an opener. In the last 5 years, I've had very intimate experiences of both mental health issues with the people around me, with my family, my own mental health, and also I've been into communities in the Amazon where mental health is treated very differently from the way in which it's treated in London. And I think the way in which one includes or excludes is more than a philosophy. It's a way of being, it's a way of thinking of the world and the earth in conjunction with humans. And so I chose the word cosmologies because these are ways of imagining relationships between human and non-human worlds across time and space. And I mean that also in terms of across time and space in our own minds, from the times when we're healthy to the times when we're not. Political cosmologies are material and immaterial ways of imagining our own being in the world and imagining how we can act on human society. And that's the politics of them. They can engineer and regulate or destroy and disorder relationships between people and between humans and other natural beings. I know that colleagues of mine in the LSE are very interested also in ecology and in protection of animals. And so infinite justice for me felt like a very appropriate thing to talk about as it stretches back into the past to honor and carry forward legacies of people who gave us this place, the things we are doing today. We're sitting in the old theater, which was occupied in the 1960s. We're here with people who resisted war, with people who've marched every 2 or 3 weeks against the war in Gaza. And we're here for the future of our children and the future of the planet. And I think also infinite justice stretches beyond humans. For me, that's really, really important. It stretches to trees, which might seem mad. It stretches to earth, to animals, oceans, and all non-living beings. What it doesn't stretch to is the as-yet unmade killer robots that Elon Musk would have populate the earth, which we no longer can live in. The three segments of my talk, symptomatic imperatives, listening, and political cosmologies, proffer just vignettes. So it's a flavor of the thousands of pages of transcripts from interviews that I've been doing over the last 5 years, and that not just I, but my graduate students, my former colleagues, people on projects with me have been doing across multiple different countries. And I've tried to include several from different countries, but inevitably, because we're here in the UK, I've represented a lot more of the young people from the UK, whom I really am so fond of and have been teaching for 33 years. So let's move then to symptoms, to diagnose the world in which we live. And I agree with Arundhati Roy, and the fact that she wrote this in 2002 says something so very sad about our time. There is no easy way out of the spiraling morass of terror and brutality that confronts the world today. How right she was, how right she continues to be, and my title is in honor of her as well. Tired and anxious all the time is a quote, not from one interview, but from 15 or 16 out of the 300 interviews that we've done so far. Tired and anxious all the time is the theme of more than 100 of the interviews that we've been doing. And we've been doing interviews with 18 to 30-year-olds. So if 18 to 30-year-olds are tired and anxious all the time, what about the rest of us? What about the 8-year-olds, the 12-year-olds, the 17-year-olds, and the 70-year-olds? How are they feeling? Neoliberal capitalism in its various racialized forms is just one of a long line of political cosmologies, which, like religious fundamentalisms, tries to convince us that there is no way out. There is no alternative because, according to the proponents of this political cosmology, anything else would be worse. But how could it get worse? Seriously, how could it get worse? As we watch buildings crumbling in beautiful cities, in amazing historical places, and in places where there are little children, how could it get worse? So to face that, one of the things I try to do, and which I think you all try to do as well in your own ways, in the different places you work in, is to exercise courage. Even if that courage is a courage exercised through real fear. I think fascist political cosmologies like the ones that I refer to on this slide, many of which are propped up by the kind of work that people do at LSE, sadly. Protestations about how democratic we are, or how free our speech is, or how enlightened our philosophical underpinnings are really underpinned by tremendous intellectual cowardice, by false equivalences, which I've heard and read in the papers all over from esteemed institutions in the US, from here, from India, for the last 10 years. Demonization of groups, othering, violation, incarceration, and mass murder. And I thought, oh my God, what a horrible, horrifying list, and how every single Instagram reel at the moment is made up of that list. One needs to exercise constant courage, and that means doing it as much at the dining table as one does it at work. And that's hard, because it means you have no break. You might go from a discussion of whether or not a genocide is going on, a denial of people's humanity at work, to a discussion of whether or not it's okay to change your body or to be trans at home. And to take up that baton and to have those discussions all the time is exhausting, and hence tired all the time. But along came a savior, apparently. Neoliberalism found its latest hook, and its latest hook is AI. But are we lemmings? We evidently are. While useful to autocrats, as you can see, capitalist hype about AI has reached monumental levels of mendacity. So why are schools, universities, our university, lining up to buy Microsoft, Anthropic, and Google products? We need to be asking that question not just to ourselves, but to the people that are investing in these tools. I want to read you just a tiny little bit of this amazing World Economic Forum study on AI. Recent research by Cognizant and the Forum reveals that demand for digital skills such as AI, big data, and technology literacy is accelerating far more quickly than global supply. Lemmings, 94% of leaders face AI-critical skills shortages today. Reskilling and upskilling, redesigning roles around human-AI collaboration, embedding workforce planning into strategy cycles, and leveraging the full spectrum of HR levers are listed as four critical ways for leaders to navigate the skills paradox. Here we go with all the language. LinkedIn, dear old LinkedIn. LinkedIn's analysis of upskilling trends, get this, reveals that workers are also taking control of their own development, with the proportion of workers with AI skills having increased by at least 100% across all sectors since 2016. What have we been doing with ourselves in the last 10 years? Obviously, we've been upskilling ourselves with AI. But leading to more global crises is AI's thirst for water. And a UK government's own paper on this subject says that actually, if the data centres continue to consume water at the rate they're going, we will have drought across much of the UK within the next 5 years. You can go to these papers, they're all on the uk.gov online. So, it feels like an apocalypse sometimes. When my friends are ringing or writing from the continent, when they're writing from Portugal, where 3,000 firefighters were deployed against heat waves, where Hurricane Melissa, my other friends in Jamaica, destroyed infrastructure so severely that till now, a third of the island still needs to be rebuilt, or flash floods across Pakistan, poor old Pakistan, which is always accompanied by all kinds of other fragilities. And it's always the poorest and the weakest who are pushed under by those floods. So what would it mean to have intellectual honesty about this at all costs in the university? Well, it would mean that the university didn't suddenly ditch the arts and humanities and decide it was going to spend all of its money and all of its talent and all of its phenomenal institutional power pursuing new schools about AI. That would be one thing that we would do. The conservative right, the far right, and the liberals, who fear that socialism would deprive them of their privileges, tamper with the language of policy, regulation, framework, and law, especially those that govern what can and cannot be publicly represented, read in classrooms, or said on the news. These groups have expended considerable energy building false binaries and equivalences, a moral inversion, which I don't tell you because I think any of you can't see it for yourself. I tell you because it makes me so angry that I just need to say it. If you will, between people who are against torture, war, and discrimination, and those who are torturing, making war, and genocide, there is an equivalence because they talk about a spectrum. The far left, those evil people that want free schools and gardens, and the far right, who'd like to get rid of half the people, so that they could get more money. Most insidiously, they've persuaded once liberal public media and universities to intellectualize these false equivalences and to theorize the past and the present through terms like polarization, my particular bugbear, and neutrality, something LSE prides itself on. Well, and this is where, if my child didn't have his headphones on, he could tell me off severely. I say, fuck your neutrality, seriously. To resist this, we have to treat everything as evidence, gather and validate evidence in systematic and creative ways, place history and historiography at the center of every single discipline. Increasingly, I feel, there is literally no point having an education if you don't do history all the time, constantly hold people to account. History is not just yesterday. History could be what happened and what was misreported in the minutes of a meeting in the institution that you're in a school, in parliament. History is what disappears from those minutes, minutes after the minutes have been written. and who gets to control that narrative. The vast right-wing ecosystem thrives on myths and lies repeated transmedially across television, across radio, across all kinds of memes on social media, and on disinformation and propaganda. Here, the building of tech systems that function through biased AI and Gen AI and the co-option of mainstream media work in tandem with all kinds of mainstream media outlets. Chaos can then be diagnosed as a symptom of liberal decay, the fallout from contemptible social justice initiatives, as they did after 2020, after George Floyd and the protests. Suddenly there was a massive backlash. And suddenly the diversity initiatives started by institutions like this one became a threat to the freedom of speech of everybody. And they had to be rooted out, root and branch. And they're treated with that kind of authoritarian control. Under cover of chaos, public capital finds its way into private hands. In India, in Turkey, in Brazil, here in the UK. And public utilities like schools and hospitals are usurped. Fascism can then arrive as a liberator. It does it all the time. The solution to liberal, moral, and political decay. And of course, I'm not going to contest the fact that there is liberal, moral, and political decay. The fact that they opened the door for fascism is evidence of that. So we have to then, on top of getting up and making breakfast for kids who don't really want to go to school because school is too stressful, including the midnight phone call from the person whose thesis is not quite ready but has to be submitted, including watching people on the bus reading reform leaflets and talking about getting rid of the migrants from the country, we have to recognize fascism and resist it in all its many guises. And its guise might be a government minister speaking about the people, or its guise might be someone turning down your right to take up a scholarship because there are too many migrants, because fascism comes in many guises. Here is a very brave person that spoke out beautifully, that spoke out powerfully against the fascist regime in Brazil and was murdered for it. And the Franco sisters, the one alive and the one dead, both have contributed massively to the fight against fascism across the world, not just in Brazil. But of course, cycles of elections mean that when one dictator goes down, another one is on the rise. So you might think, okay, the progressives have won the elections, let's take a break, because you want a break, right? Everybody wants a break. But no, because Bolsonaro is in prison, drinking champagne, grooming his son to take over. So the next fascist dictator is on the rise. In the next segment, I'm going to barely be able to get through it, but I'm going to read the words of many, many young people that I've interviewed over the last 5 years. And I'm mostly quoting from people I've interviewed, though I have a few that have been interviewed by others. So I could tell you 100 things about them. The transcripts are 40 pages long, but I'm trying to shove it all into one short quote. Samidul from London says, I'm from three generations of transport workers. I lost my mum to cancer, age 13. That was a long and sad story. Now a junior doctor earning minimum wages, working back-to-back 13-hour shifts, getting to watch the NHS being ground into mince. This is a very London thing, but I think we'll know what he means. Not even sold, yeah? That would have made some kind of fucking sense. It is being systematically wrecked, flushed for free. That's what capitalism does. That's what privatization does. Dad thought he could be proud, but all our neighbors do is complain about the NHS and us junior docs going on strike. And they're right to complain, of course. My girlfriend and I meet each other once a month because of her shifts and my shifts. I would definitely say that we are in love. These were taken from two slightly different paragraphs. I've joined them together, but I want you to see the continuity. I want you to see that we are in love, and then what happens to that. And recently she was thinking about leaving London and going to volunteer as a medic in Gaza. But I can't do that, so it would be the end of us too. Everything in my life feels fragile and futile, but I can't think too much about it because there are always forms to fill out. Maybe I need therapy. Does that resonate with any of you? Maybe I need therapy? Yeah. Not everyone who calls themselves a feminist is a feminist. This was kind of a fun one. I have a theme running all the way through the interviews around people who call themselves feminists and then who go on to say something really outrageous. But also people who are genuinely feminists. So I'll start with Callie, who's 27, perhaps old enough to know better. We broke up because he turned out to be a monumental fuckhead. Our values and beliefs didn't line up. He was always online watching porn reels or in the pub making jokes about females and the gays and trans people, and I won't use the words he uses as a sexual assault survivor. I can't. And even though he was 5 years older with a job and could be sort of sweet with gestures like wanting to take me to Wimbledon, he was to which I said no thank you. He was ultimately so full of hate, just a walking red flag. I never thought myself a feminist before, but if I want to have kids and real love, I must become feminist. And I like it that she said, I must become feminist, not a feminist. I just must become feminist. And here's another one. Please don't label all Indians like this, but this is one I particularly struggled with the whole interview through. She was a walking red flag. I'm not ready to get married. I still wanted to make a name for myself in my field, animation. I'm a feminist, you know. I'm like, okay, cool. But my parents have fixed up the rishta, that's the relationship. So I have agreed. Might as well go along since I don't like anyone else at the moment. My last boyfriend was a cheater. So she's modern, you know, she had a boyfriend. As for the boy, he's not somebody I would normally speak to, but he's in fact from our caste. And that makes my parents happy. They say I owe them. And that's true. For this reason, the wedding will happen, whatever. Let's see what happens after that. Wish me luck. Oh, I wish her luck. Wow. I was like, can I be on fly on the wall at the wedding, the rishta? Let's see how it turns out. I don't want to tell you what happened because I know the rest of the story, but I'm not going to tell you. Because you know people like this. So how does that connect to a hierarchy of hate? Well, her little slipped-in caste thing, you know, we're from the same caste, that's all part of what would have happened to her had she married someone from the other caste or another caste. So today in India, you can get beaten to death just for being Dalit or Muslim, a Muslim boy or man, or spat on or kicked to an inch of your life. A young Dalit man wished someone happy Holi in India and got beaten to an inch of his life. One week ago. You don't even have to say anything. I'm a visibly queer person. And then this person goes on to describe how it's almost impossible getting on buses. They've been removed from buses because the bus driver and the conductor could not tell whether they were male or female and were insisting on them revealing what they really are. I have a friend who writes poetry about being a queer Muslim girl, and she gets an incredible amount of hate from other Muslims for being queer, and from other queers for being Muslim, and from people in general for being queer, Muslim, a girl, whatever. It's a delightful world. Historically oppressed groups, however, are doing the heavy bloody lifting. This is a random one. I've used it before. I always like it because I like Megan Thee Stallion, but anyway, she got shot. She was just great at what she did. She was just being her. And she got completely destroyed for it. It's just the disrespect of a black woman in the media. Have any of you watched? There's a documentary about her life out, which she kind of made and authorized. It's very interesting to see what happens in that and how she progresses through talking about herself. I see you've seen it. There's been hundreds of murders in America and nothing happens. They just get killed and no reports, nothing like that. This happens to black women and black trans women. So it's just the misogyny and the transphobia and all of that, all in one, really. And I wouldn't have a lot of my rights if it wasn't for black, queer, and trans people. And I respect this interviewee. They're not from the community, but they see that. They see it very, very clearly. And of course, it continues. And India is trying to introduce an anti-trans bill, which is going to strip away even more rights from the most vulnerable people in the country. But of course, hey, since advanced democracies like France and the UK and the US are doing it, I mean, surely India must be advancing along the line of democracy by stripping rights from the most vulnerable people. They must have found out what the secret is. But there were also some hopeful things. Music allows me a sense of the future. We were, it seemed, there's a baby, a very little, sweet, gorgeous baby up there, Julia. I'm so happy to have my first tiny convert. We were, it seemed, in unending war. It was from 3 years old. Relatives, community members would just be gone in the morning where I lived. We got used to living without a future, but with much pain. Then when things changed, still quite recently, I was the most surprised because I had always subconsciously thought I will not be alive at 30. I had to make some decisions and I chose to come to Bogota and make music. It doesn't pay so good. Sometimes it doesn't pay at all. But with music, it allows me to have a sense of the future. And Martin is 29, so soon to be 30, still alive, making music, and kind of free. He said he wanted to be free of capitalism as well, which I thought was really beautiful. Those who uphold the life of the species, this one really had my heart. This is what I did on my sabbatical in 2024. If any of you suffered because I didn't teach you that term, I was in Peru. I was with very, very dear and loving former MCD friends, and they took me to the Amazon. And we went around, and I talked to lots of people. I talked to people in Lima, interviewed people all over. And here's someone, Juanita, who's amazing, really amazing person. I got involved in the struggle for climate justice here in Lima to uphold the life of all the species. Now it's my full-time job and my life mission. My aunt and mother are curandera, so they travel much and spend months in the mountains. And I won't explain what curandera is or are, because she explains it, really. And they've become involved in the struggles against illegal mining, while also supporting and helping the youth, including the tourists who visit Cusco, in terms of their mental difficulties and struggles. So they mediate between worlds in some way, between the plant and animal and human, and between the spirit world and the ancestors and us. In doing so, they teach them, they bond them with the land, with nature, and they bring them to an understanding of our connections in the universe. So, the future is an intergenerational work. I love this. I'm talking to young people who are telling me, I actually don't want my grandmother to have a phone because she's not teaching me all the wisdom she needs to teach me. She needs to be doing this. She needs to be sitting around the fire with me. Why is she scrolling on reels? That's deep in the Amazon jungle. Talk about wanting to educate the elders. And an international cross-border work, because these people work in Peru, but they also work with people in Brazil and in Colombia and in Ecuador. So there's a real cross-national work, and a lot of them speak Quechua, but they also have translators who speak Spanish. And an international cross-border work to preserve our nature, our trees, our rivers, our fish, our mountains, and thus... And I love that, and thus, that is the political cosmology, and thus ourselves and our visitors and all cultures. And I know if there are any of you who work on Africa or in Africa, the concept of Ubuntu will be very much at the surface of your thinking when you read this. It is truly beautiful to me that this person, completely unprompted, told me all of this. This one's really going to hit home. It isn't from an LSE student, but it is from someone who could be an LSE student. And I love her. She's a wonderful person. The only moral thing to do when witnessing genocide. I had a bougie life till now, a fab life. Friends, cats, my school was the best. My brother works in finance. It's a bougie life. I did worry about my grades during COVID and about climate change, but I didn't do anything. Then I did risk arrest. I couldn't have lived with myself if I hadn't done something about the shameful horror our government is supporting in Gaza. The only moral thing to do is to speak out against the misleading reports from British institutions. Now, she's not a sociologist. She's studying to become a primary teacher. The media, the BBC, about everyone there at the demonstration being anti-Semitic, and about every Palestinian child there in Gaza going on to become terrorists. My parents are pretty basic British people who used to vote Conservative till COVID. And she really rolled her eyes. She did a proper eye roll, yeah. I know, they voted for Boris Johnson. I look at the kids, I feel like it could be them, those poor little faces covered in bomb dust. It could be them, and who would I be then? I'm quite a basic person. I love she says that twice. A lucky person, never too bothered, but I am now. We have all to change things now, or we'll wake up one day and we are Nazis. We are monsters. I really genuinely think that has already happened, but there's still hope, hopefully. Now to China. I had the most amazing, brilliant research associate working with me in China. Hao, if you ever watch this, your interviews are amazing and wonderful. They're better than mine. So this was an interview with my doctoral student, Hao, and Bingqian's doctoral student, who's been working with gig workers as well as with people who work in big companies. And this is just one of the many amazing interviews he did when he was working with me on the project. So this is a young gig worker who expounds on the extreme distress, both of the heavy work that can be involved in short-term contracts that are necessary for him to eat and live, and in the long periods of homelessness, hopelessness, and self-doubt that ensue when no gigs are forthcoming. This is an individual who has tried everything. And I mean, I went through all 50 pages, and he's tried everything. Who has not got any family that they can fall back on and has to be totally reliant on themselves at a very young age. Now I do gig work. Only when I get a part-time job opportunity can I earn money. If I don't get an opportunity, I have no income. Sometimes I don't have money to sustain my basic livelihood. But what can I do if the job is not an ideal one? It's like in my case of setting up and moving a stage. A piece of wood weighs about 80 to 90 catties, and a catty is half a kilo, so you can figure that out. He's moving pieces of wood that are about 50 kilos. I should move them for maybe 8 hours without any stop to survive. My whole body is soaked. My shoulders are red. My hands are covered with calluses. When I stop, my hands are all trembling just for that measly 180 yuan. I didn't get a job for half a month in a row now. I've become really irritable. I can't sleep all night long. During this period, I think about my future life and I feel like crying, but my tears have dried up. Sometimes I couldn't even afford food and tube tickets. I don't have any, so I can only borrow money from others in a low voice. That's shame. Shame is huge for many, many people. And sometimes others will post my poor situation as a joke on their WeChat moments. I have also lost confidence in myself, and I have scolded myself for being such a waste. That's what neoliberalism does. It infiltrates your mind. It makes you think that you not being able to get a job, not being able to survive, is all on you. There is something wrong with you. If you only changed yourself, if you only fitted in more, if you only worked harder, if you were more brilliant, if you did one more course, if you did four more internships, you'd get the job, right? It infiltrates you in that way. But what else can I do when life has to go on? I'm very sad at this moment without orders. My hair has turned gray. This is someone who's in their 20s. And I can't sleep at night, just tossing and turning again and again. So that's a very sad interviewee. And we have, myself and Hao, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of quotes exactly like this one. Not just from China, from India, from Colombia, from Peru, from the UK, from South Africa, from Nigeria. We've got quotes just like this one. So there is a thread about work running through the interviews. Here is the stage that he built alone by himself at night, carrying 50 kilos at a time. The AI-ification is supposed to make all of this go away and help us so that we no longer have to do any of this heavy lifting. Now, says someone, Devon, lovely Devon, I've been looking for jobs and there's zero, which is, I mean, it's the AI boom, right? Everything is smart this, smart that. You think they want computer scientists, but maybe they already got AI to teach AI. But don't worry, I'm going to succeed, even if I have to listen to racist customers and managers, till I find my dream job. Now, I could have written a lot about his dream job. His dream job is to build an app which helps humans to talk to their pets and to other animals everywhere. And he's been called in to work on museums, and museum artifacts, which I think is beautiful, but it's gig work again. Or I'll train to teach maths and computing. I'll have paid off my uni debt by the time I'm 50. Here was a happy chappy. I've noticed a shift in my mind, says Ida. This is another one I've used a lot in my various talks, but because it's just so, it makes me feel like this is me talking when I was 26 years old. If I live now, this would be me. I've noticed a shift in my mind, the way in which I regard things that come up on my timeline with suspicion, images and stories. I have this violent vomit reaction when I see one of those ChatGPT-style emotional manipulation shit with hundreds of stupid sentences under a title like, I didn't know I was burnt out until this happens. And then at the end of it, it's click on the link and you can buy the magnesium cream that's going to make your life so much better. Okay? Or my husband is now a woman and I'm leaving. Why I decide to join the anti-trans movement. Yeah, my mother and aunts, they just eat it up. They forward it to each other on WhatsApp. Here is a theme emerging about our fucking generation, the 50-something-year-olds who are so amenable, not just to misinformation, but to hate, so amenable to it, right? So they forward it to each other on WhatsApp, even when the person seems really sincere. Seeing that word salad-sponsored content, you know what I mean? The three staccato sentences, it was not this, but that, and then... You know what I'm talking about. It makes me sick to my stomach. I want to peel my eyes off. I want to stop myself from having watched it. But unfortunately, having done so, it's impossible to change. Sadly, next morning, like magic, my phone is in my hand again. Because yeah, looking for jobs sucks, but it's unavoidable. And this is the bit that I really thought was good. The phone is a gateway drug for older people as well, not just for younger people. It's bad. So I'm winding down this section, and I'm going to move on to the next one in a minute. Miria will be happy to hear that. But I wanted to end on a slightly lighter note. So lifelines. What are the lifelines of the 18 to 30-year-old generation now? Well, that's why in all this rubbish, internship, gentrification, me and my ends hanging on to our joys. This was a hard interview for me because I didn't always hear the words, but vibing to tracks. Yeah, you get that? Some of you are down with this language. Watching Sinners. Who's with me? Watching Sinners? Yay! Okay, stroking this cute little goddess, a cat. And I gym and I run a lot in nature as much as I can, near water if poss. Do people really talk like that? He really talks like that, if poss. She talks like that. Oh my God. Anyway, because if I don't, mental health nosedive. Okay, so I think some of you may be also runners and you know what it's like if you haven't gone to the gym, you haven't done that, suddenly you start feeling really shit. So that's a lifeline, right? Running, water, cats, nature. Good. You maybe don't understand how hard it is always hassling over money, always short, never knowing if mom has enough for rent or Nana can heat her flat. I found it really sad that Jack thought that I did not understand what it was like always hustling for money. I could have said to him, but I didn't because I thought it would have been actually overstepping to say, actually, I do know that's what it was like for me at that age too. But I didn't want to say that because that's not what it's like for me now. And that's what he was talking about. That's why we can't leave for college, even though we know there's an out for gay lads here. Insta has been a lifeline, a literal lifeline. Okay, so I was talking about how bad the internet was and the phone is a gateway drug, but I want to emphasize this now since the bloody, lazy, stupid government has started thinking about banning all social media for young people, right? Insta is a lifeline, and it's a lifeline for people who are already stuck in really difficult circumstances. So because they don't want to regulate their friends and they don't want to actually make the people in power do something to change internet architectures, they're just going to take it away from the people who are actually least of the problem and leave it with our generation who are spreading all the hate. Make that make sense? My mom is always bugging at me to have babies. That's our generation, right? Bugging at me to have babies. What for? To sit at screens for all the days and nights like I do? I don't want that. But I will always have cats. My cats are worth living for because they know how to live. They insist on it. I thought that was bloody poetry and philosophy all rolled into one. Cats are the future. Sorry to the dog people. I totally get it. Cats are the future. So it is very tempting. I think I have 15 minutes left. Yes? It's very tempting to think that all is lost, that nothing can be done, that we just have to accept the little tiny rays of sunshine, the cats and the dogs and the water and the running, and we don't have anything else. But the whole point of considering the political in a cosmological sense, of being able to name political cosmologies, is that we should be able to distinguish between the ones that have brought societies we inhabit to the brink of ruin, and now at risk of doing something that many editors of mine have complained about over the years, which is just repeating long lists of things. I'm going to repeat a long list, right? So what has brought us to the brink of ruin in a planetary sense? What has brought us to the brink of ruin? Settler colonialism. Look at the streets of beautiful Tehran, Baghdad. Look at the streets of beautiful Isfahan, Beirut. look at the streets of what once was a thriving, however sad a place Gaza, a thriving Gaza, I want you to look at the thousands and thousands and thousands of olive groves that have been cut down, burnt down, bombed down, just in the course of the last 2.5 years. Okay, so settler colonialism. Not in the past, not way back 100 years ago, today. Patriarchy, what do I need to say? I don't even need to say the word Epstein, right? But you get it, it's everywhere. Racial capitalism, religious and secular authoritarianism, the thirst for dominance over the human and non-human world, it's everywhere. They're building data centers everywhere. The lust for fossil fuels, no one can see their hand in front of their face in Bombay at the moment. The data center is pumping out so much filth, but no one can see, no one can breathe in Tehran because they've just bombed the oil wells. So pick your poison. The autonomous missiles, which I am more and more and more scared of, more and more concerned about, the autonomous missiles, which aren't really autonomous. So you have to ask yourself the question, pick your poison. Did the Americans decide they were going to bomb a children's primary school? Or were the Americans so fucking stupid that they let an autonomous weapon bomb a girls' school? You have two choices. One of them is a cover story, the other one is the truth, and both of them lead to the same place, which is no one in the world should be following these guys. No one. Not our government, certainly. So the sale of everything, the rush towards eugenicist tech, and we need to distinguish between all of those and the ones that are staving this off and offer sustaining visions. But I digress just for 20 seconds here to say, very sadly on the left, we're really busy fighting each other. Yeah, too busy to be distinguishing between these things. So we're asking questions like, are you a neo-imperialist fascist because you support Ayatollah Khomeini? Or are you a this or are you a that? You're fighting within the left. Witness Susan Abu Hawa and Mahmoud Mamdani's son fighting in public on Twitter now. Really sad, really, really sad. The baby agrees with me that it's really, really sad. So I come to the end of the talk. The last 15 minutes is going to be, what can we do differently? Who can guide us in this? Cosmologies of infinite justice care about both human and non-human worlds. And I want to make it absolutely clear that these are not just woo-woo, the spiritual world. Shaku's been dabbling in all this literature about underground root systems communicating with each other. I mean, fucking Marx was saying it. So it must be okay, right? Capitalist production disturbs the metabolic, I like that, metabolic interaction between humans and the earth. What is that? Was he woo-woo? You know, like all of you capital scholars, all progress in capitalist agriculture is a progress in the art, not only of robbing the worker, but of robbing the soil. All progress in increasing the fertility of the soil for a given time is progress towards ruining the more long-lasting sources of that fertility. Right? If I hadn't told you this was Marx, and you'd heard the word fertility twice, you could have been forgiven for thinking this was some kind of Instagram influencer, right? Who's trying to get you into, new age living. Capitalist production, therefore, only develops the technique and the degree of combination of the social process of production by simultaneously undermining the original sources of all wealth, the soil and the worker. That is us, our tired, anxious selves. A Cosmopolitics of Relation, one of my favorite writers, Malcolm Ferdinand, who has, I could have quoted 1,000 things from this beautiful book, Decolonial Ecologies. A Cosmopolitics of Relation, of restitution and reparation, totally different things, restitution and reparation, of transgenerational justice requires the recognition of the legal status of ecosystems, animals and non-humans. For me, that is how I am a Marxist, to say this. It is not that I have moved into some new age spiritual realm. That is my Marxism, to be able to say that the earth also is a worker, and we are working it to death. And the preservation of the world between humans and non-humans. If the imaginative work of creating new worlds feels difficult and overwhelming to you, that is because it is. It is. So many people I know have ended up going to work for a bank. Yeah. And then they drop me a little email, and I love them so much for doing this, because I appear to be the moral conscience holder of a lot of my old MCDs. And they drop me an email and say, I'm really sorry, I'm hoping that in a few years I won't be doing this. And I'm like, my God, I love you. I understand why you're working for, fill in the blank, whoever it is you're working for, big company. You have to pay off those debts. I do understand that. Because it feels impossible to get out of the situation. And this beautiful book by Rupa Maria and Raj Patel, any of you read it? Inflamed. It's an amazing book. Because repeatedly and all through the book, it uses really rigorous research and evidence to talk about what is wrong with the body, what is wrong with the earth, what is wrong with medicine systems, what is wrong with healthcare, what is wrong with the doctors, you know, how we are all dying slowly. Deep medicine requires, they say at the end of the book, because obviously you have to read through to get to the tiny bit of hope at the end, a new cosmology, one that braid our lives with the planet and the web of life around us. Strange, isn't it? I felt like I fabulated these things after coming up with this weird title for my talk at the end of the day. No, I didn't Google who has talked about, you know, cosmologies. I just stumbled upon this at the end of the book, long after I had already given in that title. The anatomy of justice stretches from the hospital to the forest. There we go, from the hospital to the forest, from the ocean to the school, from the prison to the sky. I found that very beautiful, but the book itself is much better. It really is a braided tale. Seeing, representing, and perhaps knowing Eduardo Cohen's work is really fantastic. I know that some of my students are sick of hearing me say this. They've even read the book cover to cover, and they love it. Seeing, representing, and perhaps knowing, even thinking, are not exclusively human affairs. Attending to our relations with those beings that exist in some way beyond the human forces us to question our tidy answers about the human. And no, in my beautiful film class, I'm not talking about ghosts, although I do sometimes talk about ghosts. I'm actually talking about the non-human world. Eduardo Cohen, in asking whether and how it is possible to access how forests think, not just if they do, explores the possibility of trans-species intimacy. Now, this sounds like the beginning of a really terrible porno, and I promise you it is not. It's actually a political cosmology. It is a project of justice and restitution. Really, it pushes the boundary of our imagination of relationality far wider through acknowledgement that animals and plants and birds and trees make and read complex matrices of signs. And that's why this is a media studies book, because he talks about Charles Peirce for about a third of the book. He's talking about the ways in which animals and forests make sign systems to guide us and to tell us, this is what you're doing wrong. Don't do it, or danger is here, or we're going to get you if you do that. We're going to get you. You're going to be flooded. There's going to be a mudslide. They tell us, and they tell us, and they tell us, and we do not heed it, because capitalism, obviously. Through acknowledgement that animals and plants and birds and trees make and read complex matrices of signs in attempts to know humans and to communicate with us. I want to give a shout out to my beautiful older son, who is not here today, but whose artwork I'm using liberally. Visionary feminism is a wise and loving politics. Love cannot exist in any relationship that is based on domination and coercion. Males cannot love themselves in patriarchal culture if their very self-definition relies on submission to patriarchal rules. When men embrace feminist thinking, and I'm so happy today to see so many beautiful feminist men in this room whom I've worked alongside for 16, 20, 25 years, I think you really know what I mean, yeah? Males cannot love themselves in patriarchal culture. You're just not allowed to. When men embrace feminist thinking and practice, which emphasizes the value of mutual growth and self-actualization in all relationships, their emotional well-being will be enhanced. A genuine feminist politics always brings us from bondage to freedom, from lovelessness to loving. But remember, not all people that call themselves feminists are genuinely feminists. And I'm thinking back to all those absolutely rotten Happy Women's Day messages I got just after the bombing of the Minerb school. Yep, there was a lot of that. But from lovelessness to loving is something I'm always aiming for everywhere I go. Feminism holds that the gesture of rebellion is inexplicable, and at the same time, the only rationality that liberates us. Today we see a battle for political spirituality. I'm seeing my signs everywhere, in the streets. And I think it is political spirituality. Veronica Gargo, wonderful, amazing book, Feminist International. Anybody read it? Highly recommend it. What are the implications for feminisms of the latest forms of postmodern imperialism that stalk the globe? Asked our own Anne Phoenix and Avtar Bra many, many years ago and are still stalking the globe today. So this is the problem, I think, that how are we going to respect the non-human? How are we going to respect the non-human when we don't even respect the human? When we want to dehumanize the human. With mass violence, the problem is immensely complicated, since the wrongs are not only committed against persons, but against the concept of personhood itself. Now this quote, this beautiful quote from Chris Manjapra, brings me all the way back to the work I was doing when I was an 18-year-old, and I started reading Toni Morrison's Beloved, and I was in a philosophy department, and I was really interested in the concept of personhood. What made us human? What makes us human? And that is the question that Toni Morrison asks in every one of her books, again and again and again. What makes us human? When people are trying to dehumanize us, take away our subjectivity, teach us that we are less than animals, what keeps us human? And it's a really important and difficult question. But I want to put that question on pause for a minute. My last slide will come back to it. I want to talk again for a minute about what makes us human, but I want to do it in a practical way. I love this poem by Nikita Gill, which takes from the words of James Baldwin, although AI, for all its skills, told me that this was a poem written by James Baldwin, so obviously it doesn't know everything. Every bombed village is my hometown, and every dead child is my child. Every grieving mother is my mother. Every crying father is my father. Every home turned to rubble is the home I grew up in. Every brother carrying the remains of his brother across borders is my brother. Every sister waiting for a sister who will never come home is my sister. Every one of these people are ours, just like we are theirs. We belong to them and they belong to us. That is what makes us human. Last 3 minutes. In an account called I Teach English Poetry, published posthumously in his collection If I Must Die, Rifat Alarir describes how his tough love for his students made him something of a feared and respected figure. Still trying to protect his students and to challenge them to write poetry, even as his family and his home were being bombed, his love for them and theirs for him only grew stronger. Until one day, as he recounts, I was queuing at the bakery, and one of my students insisted on giving me his place. And I insisted, never, because Israel has made everybody equal. He's killing everybody, making everybody suffer almost the same. I would never take your place. I learned from this student the beautiful gesture of offering me his place, because offering me his place meant I could save an hour or more. And sometimes you could queue for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 hours, by the way. And when you get close, they run out of bread. So that's a big sacrifice. Later on, I met another student of mine. I was queuing way ahead. He came heading to the back of the line, and I met him, and I insisted on giving him my place. As a reaction to that student offering his place, he refused. But again, the gesture, the message was there. I'm sure he would do the same for others. You know, learn by example, by role models. That is being human. So, what if we start and end with that injunction? We choose our world, and the world chooses us. We are involved with the world and others in an inextricable tangle, and the others include non-human beings. Your freedom cannot be willed without leaving behind its singular relevance and without willing freedom for all. Thank you very much.
Talk.
I'm sure that it has generated so much thinking in the room. We don't have so much time. I will invite rounds of questions. I would like to invite you to identify yourselves before you ask the questions. And I would like to invite, hopefully, two or three questions to start with. Any hands? We have one upstairs. Please bear with me for a minute. And one here. We have a third question. Okay, let's start with the person on top there, and we'll take all the three questions together.
Yeah, of course.
Hello. Thank you so much for this great lecture. My name is Andy Tay. I used to be a media communication development student under Shaku. I just want to circle back to what you said about the importance of history and acknowledging the historiography of cultural narratives and how that is important in order to inspire inclusive and less fascist political futures. Moreover, how do you imagine making knowledge more accessible across different educational and knowledge acquisition divides in order to inspire political cosmologies that are more inclusive and, as you said, feminist in a way?
Thank you. Take the question.
Hi, Ali Naswer, current MCD student. Thank you for that wonderful lecture. I really loved how you brought in so many different writers and authors, from Arundhati Roy, who's one of my favorites, to James Baldwin, and even including the art of your own son. And I wondered if you could speak more to the role that you see art playing in infinite justice, in reimagining the world. You know, even just thinking of Beloved by Toni Morrison, like I often feel like when I read Morrison's work, like I'm sitting at her feet and learning so much and taking in so much. So yes, I'd be curious to know more about how you see art fitting into this.
Last question for this round, please.
Hi, I'm Amya. I was also an MSc Media and Communication student, graduated in 2023. At some point you mentioned how one of your students felt guilty about taking, I'm assuming, a corporate job, and said that in future they would want to come back to doing what is that matters to them most. I'm in a similar boat, doing a very corporate job. When I was a student, I also wanted to do so much and write so much about stuff that mattered to me, but money is, you know, something that we all need at the moment. And my sort of primary concern is that when I finally reach that point, when I have financial security to do what I want to do, it would be too late. And I think that is something that I think about, I think too much. And I love, you know, maladaptive daydreaming, thinking about the day when I'm finally doing something and I'm with the people, with my friends, with my professors. But it seems like it would be too late. So what would you say to people who constantly live in that fear? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Great questions. Great question, Andy. How to make knowledge more accessible? Well, I have a tiny manifesto that I've written about this because I really think it's important that we realize that everywhere is a classroom. So it doesn't matter where you are. And some of you who are chatterboxes like me will recognize this. Whether I'm waiting in the swimming pool for my kids' swimming class to finish, and I'm chatting to the person next to me whom I've never met before, and we're talking about something, I know that I can turn everything to politics. Everything. You know, like, okay, so why has the cost of such and such a thing, which is supposed to be really free or cheap, gone up so much? And they're like hooked. Because like you, they're also worrying about money all the time. And actually, that's okay. I know I'm doing my thing. I'm doing the political organizer thing. But 2 weeks later, I've got that person's phone number and they'll turn up to the anti-privatization protest at the Lewisham Shopping Center, you know? So everywhere is a classroom. And I think making knowledge accessible is not about saying, come to LSE and sit in a lecture theater. It's about saying, in your life, what does your experience tell you about injustice? What does your experience tell you about inequality? And how are you solving that problem? How's it working out for you? Are you sleeping okay at night with the things that you are okay with? The fact that, you know, you get your weekend because those cleaners are working 18-hour days? Are you okay with that? And actually, everywhere is a classroom because you're also learning about these people. You're talking to them. I've had interviews with people in India who are absolutely cool with injustice. They're really down with it. You know, they're kind of vibing injustice. And they're like, these people were born to pick up my shit. Yeah, and I'm learning about them. I'm learning how far I can push them. And I want to segue into answering your question. Because absolutely everywhere you go, you can make a nuisance of yourself, right? Right from the word go. So you're in a corporate job, right? How can you fuck it up? Right? How can you really get these people thinking about how scummy they are? Yeah, you do that, right? So you're already doing it. I don't even need to tell you that. That is just such an important part of understanding. Obviously, there are public libraries, and public libraries are wonderful, amazing spaces. You can do a kind of therapeutic work in public libraries, but you can also have events because they're a space, and you need space for these kinds of things, but also all spaces are places where you can teach. And you can teach just through experience, or you can make a blog or a film. And here I segue to your point, which is I think that all of those people that you talked about, James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, Nikita Gill, these are people who on, whether it's on Instagram or it's in a published book, what they are trying to do is they're trying to turn politics into something that is absolutely viscerally accessible to everyone. Not that Toni Morrison is accessible. I mean, my God, I spent nights, you know, wrestling with her prose. But I think art is accessible. If it's on a wall, if it's graffiti, if it's in a museum, it doesn't matter. It's really accessible. It's a way of actually saying this terrible thing is happening. If you think of Guernica and then you think of Gaza, I see the two things side by side. The sad thing is the market in art, obviously, the market in production. But, you know, like, we've got to take little bits of glimmers of hope from wherever we can. We've got to understand that we've got to make alternatives to markets. You know, without letting AI steal our ideas. We've got to have alternatives to markets. I think art and literature and humanities are the heart of, in fact, I'm going to say this in a, it's like a sacrilege to say this in a social science institution. I would just let social science go and just have art and literature and music. We would be so much happier. Yeah, especially get rid of the economics. God, yes. I answered your question.
We'll have another round of questions on this happy note. So we have one.
Any online? Are we taking any online questions?
In the following round. So let's have another round here. We have one, two, three. So we'll go in a row.
Okay. Thank you, Shaku. It's a pleasure to be seated here and listen to you once again. My name is Zainab, and I'm a former MCD student. But this question is also from Kirti, who is online and a former MCD student. I'm sure Shaku knows her. She asked two questions and refers to two incidents. She says, I have not been able to stop thinking about the rows of small graves of young girls killed in Iran by the American missile strike and about the defense secretary mocking their deaths by demanding to know what girls were doing attending school to begin with. And then she also talks about AI being used in war by ICE and how she watched a clip of the CEO of Palantir responding to a question about AI being used in Gaza, saying that, yes, it is killing people, but these people are terrorists. Then she asks, in a moment like this, where violence is both technologically mediated and publicly justified with such certainty, what does justice actually mean? Is there any justice for family, for families who lose their children and loved ones in wars they had no role in? That's the question.
Thank you. We'll move down the same row.
Hello, I'm Tuan. I'm 16. And thank you for your like focus on young people. I think it's really empowering. But I would say I do quite a lot of political work, and I live in South London. I've talked to a lot of young people, and they're really disillusioned. And it's really, like, it troubles me a lot. And I've also talked to a lot of people who are, like, living in really harsh conditions. And I've noticed that the people who care are the people who can afford to care. So all these people who are suffering so much, they just don't care anymore. And I was just like, with young people, and these people, what have you like seen? What works to help them like have hope again?
Yeah. Please pass it on there.
Hi, thank you for the lecture. Slightly unrelated, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts. In the UK, we're seeing a bigger or an issue across the political spectrum about freedom of speech. To one side, you're getting pretty reformist sort of hate tweets, which are actually getting prison sentences. But on the other side, we're also seeing the prescription of Palestine action, which is pretty some extreme action. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on to what extent should we have absolute freedom of speech and how it should be policed.
Great question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to take all three, and I actually think all three questions are related to each other. So what does justice mean when you're looking at extremely powerful people making fun of the murder of hundreds of little children? Actually, they weren't just girls in that school in Minerb. There were boys as well, and I want to acknowledge that. So many little boys killed there as well. So looking at that row of small graves, I think different people will make decisions about what they're going to do. And I have no doubt in my mind, in answer to both of your questions, that sometimes there is something worse than being completely alienated, disaffected, and silent. It's becoming so angry, so enraged, so hurt, and so harmed that you're going to go away and harm other people. And I think that is worse. That is worse. We're seeing it in 12-year-old boys who are joining Boko Haram in Nigeria and kidnapping and blowing up 11-year-old girls. It's really terrifying. We're seeing it in the UK, in the rise of extreme misogyny, people sitting online all the time, like even in 8-year-olds playing Roblox, you know, like using misogynist language and talking about, you know, really queerphobic things. So there are things that are worse than being completely disengaged. But of course, I want to come to the disengagement. So in order to answer your question and your question together, I would say that one experience, just one experience of taking some small action and seeing justice happen, even if it's the tiniest thing, you complained about something, someone's pissing in the stairwell of your council estate again and again and again, and you did something about it and you actually found that that worked, and even if it wasn't you who did it, your auntie did it or your cousin did it, it actually works to give so much hope to that entire community. So one example was the attempted closure of a huge hospital ward or the A&E in Lewisham. And lots of young people were really politicized. Young people who had absolutely no hope of anything were politicized by that because it meant so much that their nan could come to the accident and emergency, and they came out on that campaign. I don't think that how they are now, that disaffection is really bad. For years and years and years, I've talked about this in relation to politics. Tsai Ing-yao uses this beautiful phrase about disaffection, that it's a kind of protective mechanism. And they are waiting inside to emerge. It doesn't mean it's the end. It's a bit like if you've had trauma, dissociation briefly protects you in a way from the horror that you're going through. But at some point, if they have even one experience or one brush with something that looks like hope, it'll open up into something else. I don't say that'll happen to everybody, but I have actually watched it happen to young people in Southeast London. So I don't think it's just the people that are privileged that care. I've seen some of the people who've been displaced in Somalia come to London, living in council estates in East London, and they're the ones out there protesting about the children in Palestine. They know what it feels like. So they didn't allow it to stop them completely, and they're not privileged by any means. But I really do appreciate your, I sympathize with your anxiety that this is where the story ends. It ends in cynicism. It ends with them doing nothing. And to answer your question about freedom of speech, I think freedom of speech has now become an almost meaningless phrase used by politicians all across the UK. I want to hang on to something about freedom of speech, but I want to say that there are always limits. And of course, life is the limit, number one. Humanity, humanization is the limit. Dignity is the limit. If your freedom of speech is against somebody else's right to life or right to dignity, then your freedom of speech needs to be curtailed. And I would say that as much about my freedom of speech as I would about yours or yours or yours. So who are the people who want absolute freedom of speech? They are people who want to dignify robots and dignify speech above the life of babies and little girls.
And you should always call them out. It's a bit like that rhetoric about polarization. You know, what do you want? Those evil leftists who want free childcare, you know, on one hand, and those Palantir CEOs on the other hand. Which can you choose? It's so dangerous on the ends. Let's just come to the middle and have a mush between them, right? Palantir CEOs, you know, running gardens, et cetera, with robots, whatever. What do you get in the middle? And I think that's false. You need to reject all these false narratives, these false equivalences that this is the same as that. So me telling you that you can't call someone a cunt in a classroom, that's not me interfering with your freedom of speech. You calling someone out, saying that you cannot be trans, that's interfering with their dignity of life and living. That's not you challenging their freedom of speech. That's you challenging their freedom. So I think we need to bring back the meaning to words by insisting on not having this mushy terrain in the middle between two extremes, which are actually fake extremes. I don't know if that speaks to answer your question, but it's an intellectual challenge. Whether you're 12 years old or 16 or 28, it's a constant challenge to do this. But freedom of speech, who says that freedom of speech is the ultimate freedom? Freedom is the ultimate freedom, you know? And you don't need hate speech if you've got freedom.
Thank you. We will take some questions from the online audience now. Please go to the back.
So we have some questions about feminism. Shaku, what does feminism mean for you? A question from Sabine from Botswana, former MCD student. Can you share a little more on your thoughts on the pushback on feminism, especially amongst young women? And what are your thoughts on feminism and personhood from your interviews in Peru?
Are those three separate questions, or was that one single question? Three separate questions.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Answering what would feminism mean to me is like a whole hour of talking. So you've actually set me off. So I'm going to start with feminism and push back against feminism amongst the young people that I've talked to. Yeah, a lot of people that I interviewed, and this is a lot of people that I interviewed, said that they wouldn't want to call themselves feminists. And they said, I wouldn't want to call myself feminist, because, and you name it, feminists are killjoys, they're boring, they're sad. Or feminists are, and this is interesting, coming out of China, there's this huge new discussion in China about misandry. And of course, it's yet another one of those sort of free speech type misdirections. But it's like, oh no, feminist means you hate men, you're so horrible, you're oppressing men. Shouldn't the young men have a right to come back? And actually, sorry, no, it's still the same old misogynists who are oppressing men. But explain that. Explaining that takes time. It takes a lot of time, which people don't have necessarily in a quick online discussion. So there is a lot of pushback against feminism. But I think actually there's also a generational divide between three different generations, especially in China, but also in India and here. In China, you've got a socialist generation of women who fought in a revolution and who had experience of socialism. And to them, young women saying, I want to grow my hair long and I want to have lipstick is not feminism. So their refusal to recognize certain young people's gestures as feminism is causing those young people to say, oh, fuck off then. I'm not interested in socialist feminism. Yeah, I'm going to be whoever it is that says I'm allowed to be like I want to be, that person has got my vote. That's my feminist. You know, that's my icon. And I think that's really troubling and really upsetting. So I think feminism and personhood in Peru, a lot of people in Peru didn't talk about feminism. That was really, really stark to me. Nor in Colombia. It was not a discourse there. There was much more of a discourse about personhood, humanity, human beings, you know, peace, wanting to be a peacemaker. People didn't talk about feminism explicitly, and yet almost everything they said and did was about it. And I think partly that's to do with the legacy of religion. There's an enormous push of Catholicism across Peru. It's overwhelming. It's almost sort of breathless at moments. I did meet people, in fact, one person who thought women's empowerment, they talked about women's empowerment, and they talked about the church empowering women, you know, by telling them not to have abortions, and the church empowering women to do various things. So there was a different discourse there. But by and large, the indigenous women I spoke to were unbelievable feminists. They were out there protecting the trees. They were working in organizations in the fields, raising kids, doing all kinds of things, making their children into feminists in many different ways because they had that whole sense of personhood. So coming back to the first question, what does feminism mean for me? It doesn't exist for me outside of a framework of socialism and humanism. So I would say that you have to make choices, and your choices constantly make or unmake your feminism. You could be a feminist for 40 years making certain types of choices, and then you can make a choice that is misogynist. That is quite possible. The idea that you become a feminist, you stay a feminist, and you can never do anything that is destructive to boys, for example, to young boys, that you could be a feminist and if you slap your kid, that's a feminist slap? No bloody way. But I've met people who think that that's okay. I'm making my kids tough, yeah? So that they can be feminists, yeah? But if you go on and then you're slapping your kids, that is not my feminism. That is not my feminism.
Okay, we have a very few minutes and maybe we'll take two quick questions for final also comments from Shaku. I think we'll take the two on the top because you guys have not had many chances.
Hi, Shakuntalaji, thank you very much. Thank you for your such an eloquent expression of an attempt of trying to leash this rabid neoliberal dog armed with the fangs of corporate power and military forces. I was wondering that while I was listening to you, do you think that the retreat of welfare state, which is intertwined with the rise of the neoliberalism, does it also imply that it is the rise of the traditional ruling caste, for example, like in India, Brahmins and Baniyas, and what they are doing of the Indian politics at the moment? Second question, which is related to that, do you think that the state socialism could be a potential panacea, if not a panacea, the next step forward to form the responsible governments, or should we insist on that, the thinking educated lot? Mm. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have a question on the front. This will be the last question, and then we'll go to final comments and responses.
Thank you so much for such a brilliant talk. I learned a huge amount. I have a question, which is, you spoke about how genocide and the horrific things happening in the world today can be seen many times in history, and we can learn from history to understand the atrocities that are happening today. I wondered whether, trying to kind of understand the future, whether we can find optimism in the past or whether we're trying to look for it in the world around us, and in pockets of optimism in the world around us, how does that get transposed into industrial societies, that you can kind of build a garden that works but you can't necessarily build a city that works? Should we be looking for optimism at the moment now, or is it not appropriate given the level of suffering? Thank you so much.
It's great, two great questions. I'm not sure I can do justice to that in 2 minutes, but the rise of the neoliberal state, so you're suggesting that the rise of the neoliberal state is also connected to caste and race politics, yeah, and that it is dismantling the welfare state, and that actually that feeds the caste and race politics. Well, you've diagnosed it quite correctly. I think that's absolutely accurate. I think it's much more likely that we'll have anti-migrant and racist and casteist sentiment taking hold and embedding itself in places where there is no welfare, where people have had their rights stripped away, where care has been demolished. Whether socialism is a panacea for that, that's complicated. Sorry?
State socialism.
No. The answer is really simple. No, it has to be a social revolution. It has to come from people. It cannot be state socialism. But I will say something. I've just come back from China, and there are a lot fewer really, really devastatingly hungry people stripped of their dignity in China, even now, years after China has capitulated to neoliberalism, than there are in India. So state socialism, I mean, I'm saying no, but I'm not going to knock it as a way of getting somewhere else. Okay? I think at times, and therefore I will call for nationalization of everything here in the UK, not straightforwardly nationalizing it, but nationalize it with communities, understand what's going on, cooperatives. Yeah, and if that's what you mean by state socialism, then maybe it has a role to play in getting us there. But we'll never get anywhere without a social revolution. I think we really need that. And that means dismantling caste, patriarchy, and race at the same time, which means we need our socialist feminists more than ever before. To answer your question, can we find optimism in the past? 100%. We absolutely can. We absolutely can. But are we willing to listen to what the past is telling us? I really don't think we are. We have at LSE three towers, which are named after very famous suffragettes. Do we recognize those towers? Yes, we all do. Right. So we honor the suffragettes. We have buildings named after revolutionaries. We have a statue of Baba Saheb Ambedkar. And yet we are so chicken shit that at LSE we have to be neutral all the time. We cannot call out dictators when they come to speak on the stage to the public. We can't even say something impolite to them. We can't even use the word genocide sometimes because it's too dangerous. And we have to give more respect to AI and machines, weapons of mass destruction, than we do to the bodies which are piled up. So we are not listening to the hope that history gives us. The Warsaw Ghetto gives us hope. People who stood up for each other in prison in the 1970s, the Matan Solidarity Refuser Network in Israel, where there are young people as young as 16 and 17 standing up and saying, I want to be a conscientious objector, that gives us hope. The anti-Zionist Jewish people all over the US who are now rejecting and refusing to believe in these kinds of hateful frameworks give us hope. It's not just the past, there is hope in the present. Would I say optimism? Absolutely not. Because stacked against us, there are billionaires who own almost all the media. And that's why in a media studies department, I'm really, really interested in political economy. I think we need to study where the money is and just go and do something with that knowledge. I was going to say blow it all up, but I got scared at the last minute. I think that's a good place to end because I'm tired enough to say that.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.